With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with the Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC. Member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.
Women to Watch is an intimate look into the lives of prominent and influential women leaders from around the world and the challenges they faced on their journey. It's the real story behind her title. Join us every week to hear more stories about women from around the world and in your own communities at womentowatch.net. Hello everyone and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch. I'm Sue Rocco. Thanks so much for being with me. Joining me in just a moment will be Joya Das. And Joya is a TV anchor and she's also a public speaking coach. She's doing all kinds of great work for women to help with their careers. And we're going to be talking about something important that happened to her as a child that really is behind her motivation and drive. Don't forget to stay with us during the breaks where you'll hear from our exclusive watch team of corporate partners. And a quick reminder to subscribe to our YouTube channel at W2W Media. So now I'm very honored to welcome to the show, Joya Das. Joya, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's so lovely.
It's great to have you. And we'll give a shout out to Kelly Hoey right at the top for connecting us and bringing us together. I appreciate her.
Kelly is a Wonder Woman on many levels, including a very good friend of mine. So I'm happy to jump in wherever she needs me.
Yeah. Well, listen, I have so much I want to talk to you about because you're so incredibly involved in helping women with their careers and on the side having your own career. And there's lots of things that you're doing, I would say, as an entrepreneur and under your own personal brand. But I'm going to start out with a quote because I think it speaks to, I'm going to guess that it speaks to what's kind of behind your drive and what has given you such audacity, I will say, over the years. You said, "I grew up with traditional Indian parents who had a very tight script for how I was going to live my life. I wasn't having any of it." Mm-mm. So I love the way you say that. And I wonder if you could just describe for our audience a little bit about your upbringing and what you're referencing.
Yeah, I mean, my parents, my mom is from Calcutta, my dad is from Burma. They had an arranged marriage and they moved to central Pennsylvania to have their family and raise me. And I think that parents who emigrate to another country, and not just my parents, fall into one of two buckets. You either concede to the fact that you have moved to another country and you are raising American children, in this case, or you try to recreate, in their case, little India in our household and hope that the outside world doesn't actually infiltrate. And I'm someone who's always had vision. I've had vision since I was 4 years old. I had a very clear idea of where I was going to go and what I was going to do. And none of that really was in lockstep with what my folks wanted, because they had these very tight scripts of what it meant to be, you know, an Indian person, what it meant to be an Indian girl. So much of their lives were informed by fear. They made this quantum leap in moving to another country, but then me being a girl, so much of them raising me was informed by fear. And I just wasn't having any of it. I knew I wanted to be a news anchor since I was four. I knew I wanted to go live my life the way I wanted to live, date who I wanted to date, travel the world. And so I left home at 18 and I paid for college and I paid for grad school and I paid for every move around the country to come to New York and do what I wanted to do since I was four, which was to become a news anchor. And now I travel the world. But that came at a cost. There's collateral damage that comes from saying, "I'm going to go do this," which is that, you know, I'm estranged from my family today. But that is, I couldn't imagine ever towing somebody else's line to live my life. It would just be a really, it would be such a horrible existence.
Mm. That's so interesting to me that at four, some of us, I don't even think we have memories of being 4 years old. And you describe watching Tom Brokaw on television, setting up your own little desk with your papers. When you think back to that time, what exactly was it that was so exciting to you in watching him and making that decision? That's what you wanted to do.
Two observations. One is it was more observing my father because it was ritualistic for him to sit down and watch the news every single day. At 6:30, everything would come to a screeching halt and that would be the thing that he would do. And I think for him as an immigrant, it was patently American for him to do this, to be informed about the, you know, the topics of the day. And I don't think that he realized that his little girl who was sitting on the floor watching him watch the news was patently seeing her future. And I think that it was a combination of, you know, this aperture of the world. My world was so little, like I said, growing up with these folks that had these strict bumper guards around my existence. There was this, the TV was the aperture to this big world that I so wanted to be a part of. And the articulate way in which, you know, Tom Brokaw talked about this world was really appealing to me. And so I do need to credit my mother for being in the kitchen this entire time, watching me watch the news. And I think that she nurtured the writer in me ever since I was a little kid. She would enter me in writing contests and spelling contests and poetry contests to really nurture the writer in me. So I don't think that it was a direct line A to line B, but my mom saw something and nurtured me to line B.
Mm. You know, we talk so often about nurture versus nature, and you would seem to me to be an example of someone who it was in your DNA to be who you are today. And often young girls, you know, kind of fall in line and toe the line with what the family dynamic is and what is expected. Did you give pushback when you were growing up verbally with mom and dad, talking to them about this doesn't feel right, I want to do something else?
I'm sure that I did, but I was a pretty good kid. I'm the oldest child. The oldest child is usually a rules follower, which I was.
Yes.
However, I think that the mistake they made was sending me to Europe on a chaperone trip junior year going into senior year. And then all of a sudden, all those pictures that were on the television screen became my real life. And I got a taste of it and I wasn't going back.
So, Joya, you attended Bucknell University, and you found out while you were there that your parents did not save for college and for tuition. And again, an example of your, I love the word chutzpah.
Yeah,
chutzpah.
That's a great one.
You basically said, I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying right here. This is where I belong. What was the outcome of that?
Yeah. So another thing that I want to talk about in my upbringing, and this is an unfortunate sort of commentary on Indian culture, but I also grew up in a home of domestic violence. So I ingested very early messages about what it meant to be a woman, what it meant to be a woman with a voice, and I wanted to be both for a living. So for me, college was, you know, sort of my first break. And the only direction I was moving from that day forward was forward, not backwards. And so when I discovered second semester sophomore year that my parents had not, in fact, paid for this very expensive school, I marched myself into the CFO's office and started to duke it out with him because I needed to figure out a way to stay. I wasn't going home, which is what he wanted me to do. And so I found a doorstop of a scholarship book and just started writing and writing and writing and writing to every single scholarship saying, you know, I don't have any money. I want to be a news anchor. Will you help me? And then Bucknell's a huge sorority and fraternity school. And so sorority rush had started and that meant a week of parties. And so in one ear, you know, the school is telling me I need to go home. And then I was like, well, I'm going off to rush. And so a week of parties ensued. Letters are piling up on my dresser. I'm pretty sure all of them say I owe money. And so after rush was over, I sat down and started opening all the envelopes. And sure enough, most of the envelopes said I owed money. But there was one that I opened that read differently. And keep in mind, I'm all of 18 or 19 years old. This is a lot for me to be carrying. But I could tell that the language was different. And so I remember walking back into the CFO's office and showing him this letter. And mind you, you know, we have been at it now for weeks trying to figure out how he's going to get me to leave. And I'm saying I'm staying. And it's the first time he smiles. And he says, "You, young lady, are a very lucky girl. This alumni in the middle of, I think it was Minnesota or Missouri, I can't remember which, has agreed to fund half of your education. Now, how are we going to pay for the rest?" Long story short, we jerry-rigged a series of federal and state loans together, and yet there was still an overage of another $2,000. And he's like, "Who is going to pay this?" And I said, "Look, here's the deal. I need you to write me a loan agreement. You put whatever interest rate you need on that, and I will sign it. But you have got to get me through this. And I will pay this the minute that I graduate." And I just dug in my heels so much that he just was like, okay. And he did. And he wrote that loan agreement. And that is how I got through college. But it was this deep-seated desire to not go back home to that dynamic. And it was also this very deep-seated desire and this North Star that I had that I wanted to be a news anchor. And that was what sort of anchored me into making that very bold ask. And that's what got me through college.
Wow. Can I ask you, Joya, do you feel as though you've made peace with your past? You know, that you've accomplished so much now and that you're in a place where you feel proud and where you belong?
Great question. You know, for years, I was very mad about that. And it wasn't about the fact that I had to pay for college by myself. It was sort of the conversation that was never had with me. The respect of your child to say, you know, we can't pay for this. Now I reconciled and I realized how much that moment was a gift because I assumed financial stewardship over my life. Even till today, I could tell you exactly down to the dollar how much is in every single one of my bank accounts and my credit cards. And I think it's a gift. It's a complete gift that my parents, unbeknownst to them, gave to me because I was never going to be answerable to anybody financially ever again.
Mm. Something that you talk about a lot that I so wholeheartedly agree with is the power in talking about it. So talking about the real stuff, the tough stuff, the things in our life outside of our careers. And I'd love for you to just describe what you think the power is in people being vulnerable about who they are, where they came from, and you know what their challenges were, and how that really can help us where we sit today.
My first on-air station was a small CBS station in Casper, Wyoming, population 50,000. And I remember my general manager, who's Barteb essentially eventually probably sunk the station because it's no longer. But I remember this. He said, "Stop trying to be what you think a news anchor should be and just be yourself because you are the most unique thing that you bring to the table." And I think that was where, you know, formative years for me. I was still, you know, making my way in the world. But I think I've always been hardwired to be this person. I have nothing to lose. So I have always shared very openly and transparently about my family dynamic, my home dynamic. I've done a whole TED talk on this. And I see the power that it has to change a room. And most people, you know, now that I have clients that I'm teaching to do the same thing, it takes a ton of courage. And most people don't have the courage to be able to share that openly and transparently. But there's so much power on the other side when you do and when you have the courage to do so. I have an example of a client who was, you know, looking for work for a couple of years and just wasn't successful. She wasn't getting past job interview number one. And we started working together. She hired me. And the first few sessions, she was telling me the safe stories, the really sanitary stories that you're supposed to tell. And I kept pushing for something deeply personal. And then I remember in session four, something shifted for her. She told a story of a time that she was rendered homeless as a teenager. Her parents owned a hotel. They lived on premise. Through a series of unfortunate events, they lost the hotel and she and her family were no longer had a home. And I remember her saying this. She's like, "At that point in my life, I didn't want charity. I wanted options." That's what a kid wants at that age when you're homeless. And it was a watershed moment because all of a sudden she started showing up differently for her job interviews. And she started to make it through to job interview number two and job interview number three and job interview number four. And by the time we finished our work, she was like, Joy, I got a job. And it was for 15% more than, you know, my last role, which was a couple of years ago. And I said, that's fantastic. What do you think changed? She's like, well, A, you taught me to show up way more authentically, which I was. And B, I just had the confidence to ask for the next step in the interview rather than wait for them to come to me. Like I took real agency over the process. So I think that that is like a real life example of when you sort of break through that, you know, that fourth wall and you start to share so openly the magic that's accessible to you on the other side.
Was your TED Talk the first time you spoke openly about your past?
No, I had been speaking about it pretty unapologetically the whole way through. But I think that my TED Talk was probably the most polished telling of that story. And it was the first thing that came up whenever you Googled Joya Dawson. I found that by online dating.
Yeah. I think what happens when you share like that, that it's healing for yourself and it's also a gift to the listener. Always. If you were doing that, do you think even when you were younger, just talking about what was happening in your home, do you remember the moment you told someone for the first time? Because I think that's the moment when you have this kind of relief of the secret.
Yeah, I remember telling it to my college roommate who came from Westchester and from a very wealthy family. And, you know, her whole world was so wholesome and pure. And for me to, you know, be her roommate, be of a different ethnicity, to have this background, to have this family dynamic, and for her to have a front row seat to it, I think was an awakening for both of us, me to her world and her to mine. And even to this day, she will say to me, you know, I will never understand what you went through to go through that school, but I'm just so proud of you.
Yeah. Listen, we're going to go into our first break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about your years being a TV anchor and what is most exciting for you doing the job you've always dreamed about.
Yeah.
Stay with us for our watch team and we'll be back with Joya Das.
Hi, my name is Christy McCaffrey. I'm the founder and owner of Be The Good Media, and I'm here to share some good news with you. Today, I wanted to share with you about a guest that I had on my podcast named Jen Welby Gilbert. Jen is an elementary school teacher who says that she wants her students to know that they are never too young to make a difference and that they have the ability to change the world. After years of implementing her own program in her classroom to help her students understand the process and the value of giving and philanthropy, Jen went on to create her own nonprofit called The Giving Project for Children, where she's now created a curriculum that she shares with parents, teachers, and administrators to help encourage the study of philanthropy and giving in classrooms. How inspiring is that? That is some good news. To hear more of our conversation, you can visit bethegoodmedia.com. And there you'll also learn more about how Be The Good Media works to amplify impact-driven missions and causes. Again, I'm Christy McCaffrey. Listen here for more good news on Women to Watch.
Dear CEO, board director, and executive mentor to Fortune 500 executives through my work at the EXCO Group, firm of experienced CEOs, board directors, and global business leaders who offer real-world experience to help organizations and senior leaders grow. Today on Leadership Watch, we're going to talk about being in the driver's seat of your career. No matter what stage you're at in your career, you need to grasp that you are in the driver's seat. Understanding from day one that you and you alone are responsible for your career is critical. After all, why would you hand your career over to someone else to manage? There's no one as vested in yourself as you. And the ugly truth is that most managers are focused on execution rather than team development. So how can you ensure that your career stays on track? First, make sure you have a clear set of agreed upon goals that are measurable, and if priorities shift, rewrite them with buy-in. Two, if you see something that can be improved upon or automated, don't wait to be asked, just do it. This is good advice for tech-savvy millennials and Gen Zs who can help lead the way with AI. Three, don't insulate yourself. get to know other parts of the organization and network both internally and externally. Feel free to drive outside of your lane. And 4, while your career is yours to own, don't go it alone. Identify sponsors and mentors. Also, it's important to make self-reflection and self-assessment a habit. Think through where you want to be 5 years from now and create a roadmap for yourself. Does your current path get you there? Are you passionate about what you're doing? Do you feel challenged? Are you learning? Do you feel respected? And importantly, are you a cultural fit? And is the company a cultural fit for you? If you answer negative to any of these questions, it's likely time for some course correcting. Please follow me on LinkedIn at Dawn Zier. And if you're a senior executive looking to grow in your career, check out expoleadership.com to learn more.
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined this week by Joya Das. And Joya is a TV anchor, and she is also a public speaking coach, among other things. We'll be talking about all the other things that you're doing. But tell me what it's, you know, I think it's unusual to decide at 4 what you want to be and then go do it. And I just wondered, what is the most exciting part for you? What lights you up when you are in that role?
So to be clear, I only do business news, and I love how intelligent talking about money is. There's science, there's technology, there's math, there's politics. There's so much that impacts talking about that. But for me, it's so intelligent. That's what lights me up. I want to always be surrounded by intelligent things and always be learning. So I think that's the first layer of it. The second layer of it is that it's not scripted. You know, I'm on the trading floor. The camera is somewhere 50 feet up in the rafters because the stock exchange was not made for.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Our broadcast studio is made for trading, you know, trading stocks. And so the fact that you have to be so self-sufficient technically as well as intellectually to be able to do the thing. It is thrilling to be there when that opening bell is ringing, to know that there are cameras all over the world that are trained on that moment. And you take it for granted every single day, but I have just been really lucky to be at the nexus of it. That's what I think every time that bell goes off. I have also, I've covered news since through 9/11, through the blackout, through the pandemic. So those are some major life events to have been on the news and talking about major events in New York City. And those are things that I think that just, you know, they stay with you forever.
Yeah. I think one of the things for any anchor, reporter, commentator, you know, is to manage the emotion of things that they're talking about. And how do you handle that? Does that come easy for you, or are there times when it's difficult?
I think that it's the opposite. When you are bearing witness to so much, it actually desensitizes you. I remember it was my first week at CNN when 9/11 happened, and I walked in and everybody was gone. I didn't understand what was going on. I was just starting out, and my manager came up to me and he said, "You're going with this cameraman. You're going down to St. Vincent's Hospital. You're going to have to walk. I hope you're wearing great shoes. The World Trade Centers have just fallen, and you're going down to St. Vincent's Hospital to wait for the bodies to come in." And so we walked down. It was a super, super hot day. The medical staff at St. Vincent's was all standing on one side of 7th Avenue. The press bank was standing on the other side of 7th Avenue. And everybody's eyes was trained downtown waiting for the bodies to come in. And I remember the doctors didn't think they were going to have enough stretchers. So they had taken office chairs and put white sheets over them so that they could handle the overage. And we stood there for hours waiting, and none of the bodies ever came in because they'd all been incinerated. Mm. And I remember telling my grandmother that I didn't cry. I didn't cry until I read the New York Times the next day, and it was the last text that people who were on the plane as I was heading into the World Trade Centers sent to their loved ones. I think that for me is when the dam broke, but not necessarily when I was on the job in front of the camera waiting for, you know, what was a very, very tragic day for New York City.
My gosh, I can't imagine the, so you're having to really on the fly think of what to say. That's a lot of pressure in not knowing what's going to be happening and taking place. So that
But know that, you know, I do business news on the floor. There's no script, right? I'm looking at a bunch of screens. I have notes in front of me. And then I just talk. I'm just trained to talk. So it comes with part of my training and my DNA.
Yeah. Something else that I read, I wanted to ask you about. In 2010, you launched a documentary production company. Tell me about that and what kind of projects you did.
Yeah, I had a come to Jesus moment when my contract came up with Channel 7, which is ABC here in New York City. It's the number one station in the country, number one station in New York City. And I was like, this is all well and good, but I don't feel like I have a body of work, like in the way Steven Spielberg has a body of work that he can say that he's created. I didn't have that. And I so wanted to create that. And so for me, I started a documentary production company because I wanted to create beautiful stories and I wanted the opportunity to go back and revise them and make them beautiful. But I was still on the air. So I did take on a partner, and my partner Greta and I launched our production company with a view to get more projects. And we did for a little while, but the Dark Horse brand that really took off as a result of this venture was the business that I have today. And the reason is because we started hosting meetups to fill our, you know, project pipeline. And what I did not realize, because I'd been behind the TV screen for all these years, is there was an entire generation of Indian girl that had grown up watching me on TV at a time when no Indian women were on mainstream TV. And so now all of a sudden there were 300, first there was 8, then there was 40, then there was 300 women showing up, all because they now were coming to share that they were doing something other than the Indian parent approved doctor, lawyer, engineer profession. And they wanted to share that with me. And again, I'd been unapologetically sharing my story. Like, I wanted to do this and I didn't have the easiest path. My parents weren't behind it. I did it anyway. And I think that all of those stories resonated for them. And so they wanted to come and share. And so the documentary production company didn't really take off, but my business did.
Yeah. So today, if I were to ask you what it, there's a lot of things that you do under your own personal brand, that umbrella, events, master classes. I believe you have your own clients in the public speaking coaching arena. I guess my first question is, when you decided to start all of this, was the goal in mind to help specifically Indian women with their own careers, and has it evolved into all women, you know, a place for all women to come and really get all kinds of resources and tools for their careers?
Yeah, I mean, I think in the early years, you know, just generally, people hire people who look like them and are like them. And so because I'm Indian, that was a huge draw. But now, you know, I've had my business 12 years and I've traded television for my business full time. And the easiest gift for me to leverage is public speaking, because that's what most people want. They want to be able to have more executive presence in a meeting. They want to be able to do TV interviews, or they want to do better videos. So that's the top thing that they come to me for. Has it evolved? Yes, because as you're in business, you start to get very clear on the avatar of person, of woman that you want to work with. And so today it's someone who's between the ages of 45 and 55, has already built a big career, has some clarity on the message that they want to share. They probably travel a lot. They have a high risk profile because I'm doing your retreats in countries that are off the beaten path. And they have a growth mindset. They already invest in themselves at a great, you know, a ton, whether it's financially or time-wise. So for me, I've started to take on male clients as well, but it's because they tick all those boxes. But it doesn't necessarily have to be an Indian woman. I always have at least a few in my mastermind, but it's this avatar of human that has started to really be the moth to the flame for me.
And how much would you say, or what percent, I guess, is spent on personal development versus leadership, executive roles, you know, taking specific steps to rise to higher levels in their careers?
Yeah. So what sits at the core of my business is my mastermind. It's 12 months. It's $33,000 next year. But in that container, I am working on three things. I'm working on your mindset because I find that most women are in their own way. They might have this goal sitting out here, but they don't necessarily feel that they are worthy of that goal. So at a very foundational level, I have to work on that. I work on your personal brand. And what does that actually mean? It means, you know, you have clarity around a message that you want to share. You were homeless at one point. How does that parlay into the job that you have today? And connecting those dots and telling that story in a clear and concise way is the work. And then that container, the mastermind, culminates in those women getting up on a stage and giving a TED-style talk on a New York City stage in front of 200 people or 100 people. So for me, I believe in working on mindset. I believe in building the personal brand, but then having something really performative at the end. Because you could have just like not done any of the work all year long, but then at the end, there's nowhere to hide. Yeah, I really truly believe with all my clients that there always has to be something performative at the end so there can be bearing witness to the work that we've done together.
Yeah, it sounds incredible. If I were to ask you, how do you see the world if we had more women leading countries? What do you think that difference is, or you know, what has been missing, and why is it so important for more women's voices, involvement in policy making? Why is it so important in your view?
Yeah, I wrote about this morning. What is it that we're telling our daughters? Because I sit across so many sales calls throughout the week and women don't feel worthy of asking someone to be a mentor. They don't feel worthy of investing in themselves so they can advance. They don't feel worthy of taking up space. And so I think it starts at a very, you know, basic level. What are we saying to our daughters? And so then the next step, once you've decided that that's not going to be your story anymore, are you investing in yourself to tell a different story? Are you investing in a coach? Are you investing in any kind of growth modality so that, you know, you aren't in the same place a year from now? It pains me to sit across the table, especially from women of color, every single day and hear the same things over and over and over again. So I think that women are often in their own way. And if they could actually get out of their own way, there's the work. The other piece in answer to the question that you're asking me, I remember doing an event at the Marjorie Post home. Marjorie Post, it was heir to the Post cereal fortune. Her parents, when she was 20 years old, died in a car accident. Now, she then came into $20 million, which is a fair bit of money back in the, you know, the early 1900s, and took over the reins of the company. However, her father, while she was growing up, brought her into every single board meeting so that she could observe how a business was run. So did she fritter away that $20 million when she came into it? Absolutely not. In fact, Mar-a-Lago, which is where Trump now, you know, has a summer home, was built by her. She had a home in the Catskills. She ran the, you know, the Post cereal company for many, many years until she died. She had many husbands, one of whom was, you know, a diplomat to Russia. So I think that there is an opportunity to change that story, but it maybe starts with fathers who are, you know, very early on taking their daughters and bringing them into the boardroom and saying, this is how business is done. This is what numbers are. The numbers are sexy. And I don't know that we necessarily have, we've gone a long way, but if you think about it, it's only since the 70s that women have really entered the workforce full bore. Now women in their 50s have really entered into those senior leadership roles. But those people invested themselves in a big, big way.
Yeah, I think it's so important what you said about, you know, fathers and just men in general, becoming a part of the conversation, validating these aspirations that women and young girls have, and understanding the importance of it as well. And I think we're seeing it now more than ever. I know my own husband has had many a conversation with my daughter, you know, about how smart she is and why, you know, the world needs to hear from her. So, and it makes such a huge difference. In your life is exciting. I think, you know, you get to travel, you've met a lot of interesting people. What's difficult for you today? What is one of the things that is just a challenge? I don't want to ask you about work-life balance. What comes to mind for something that, you know, you have to kind of work on and in your own life?
Yeah, I mean, I think dialing in my sales funnel and my sales systems, that's something that I'm actively working on, because there needs to be, I'm a big believer in systems and processes, and I think that my systems and processes really need to be dialed in. And so that's what's hard for me right now. And I'm actively hiring help to be able to change that story. Instead of doing a regular intake form, I've decided to work with a young game developer, a Pakistani woman who does game development, and she's created a little video game that people can play to express their interest in my mastermind this year. So I'm not afraid of technology. I'm not afraid of innovation, but I do need to build a system for funneling folks from cold to, closed.
Yeah. I guess my last question for you, for our viewers and listeners who might be women that are looking for or just looking to be better public speakers, looking for a way to tell their own stories in a better way, leave us with some tips, some advice for doing that.
Yeah. Clear writing leads to clear thinking, leads to clear public speaking. A big favor you can do for yourself is start to journal. And journal every single day. Just put down everything that's in your head down on paper, and you'll start to see patterns. And those patterns will lead, like I said, to clearer thinking and to clearer speaking. I think that that's the shortest comment that I can make. I also think that when you're writing on there is where you have permission to dream. I think about Patricia Highsmith, who is the author of the Talented Mr. Ripley series. From the age of 15, she meticulously recorded every single thing about her life, who she talked to at school, books she read, poems that she wrote. And so much of what was in her cahier, she called them cahiers, not journals, it's a French term, is what gave rise to the Talented Mr. Ripley series, because she dared to dream characters and storylines while she was doing that writing. And that's what gave rise to what became her books and eventually became a movie. So I just think that so much of magic has yet to be accessed on the other side if you can commit to a daily practice of writing.
Yeah. I think, don't they say that public speaking is one of the, it might be the number one fear people have, humans have, to stand up in front of a group, whether it's a few or an audience of 1,000. It is. And I think that, well, I'd love to know your take on what is it mentally that someone who has such a fear and anxiety of doing that can say to themselves in the moment to help them get over that fear?
Number one, I think you don't suffer from bad speaking. You suffer from bad organization of your material. So really thinking critically about how your content is organized and how it lands is key. Think about going to a comedy show, and if the comedian gave you the punchline and then started telling you all the other pieces of the joke, that would just totally suck. And so that's why most public speaking sucks, is because you haven't given me the buildup. you've just given me the punchline, then you moved on. And I have no context for that punchline, nor can I appreciate it. I think the second piece is you only get better by practicing. So go to, you know, there are low stakes environments in which you can practice your public speaking. The line at Trader Joe's, go to your local bookstore and to a book talk and ask a question. I mean, strike up a conversation with the barista at Starbucks. There are so many low stakes places for you to practice your public speaking. And then the final thing is to record yourself. No other teacher is going to be a better mirror for you other than you taking your phone. All of us have one of these, and recording yourself for 1 minute every single day. Just a thought dump of your day, what worked, what didn't work, and seeing it back on, seeing the playback. Once with the sound down, once with the sound up, because I bet you, you've got some facial tics. You've got things that you didn't even notice about yourself that you're only going to see on playback.
Yeah, that's a great tip. But be prepared ultimately, right? If you're prepared, you'll be more relaxed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you know your stuff and you've organized your stuff, it's not enough to just know your stuff, to organize your stuff, then at least you're 30% of the way there.
Yeah. Well, Joya, I appreciate you so much coming on the show and sharing a bit of your story and for being so candid. I think it's definitely going to inspire some of our viewers.
Thank you for having me. This has been great.
Stay with us as we go into our last break, and I'll be back to close out the show.
We are CHOP, and we can't wait to show you around. We're the nation's first children's hospital. Now, a care network with more than 50 locations that continues to expand. 3 state-of-the-art research buildings with 1.5 million square feet of space. We have grown from 12 beds 165 years ago to nearly 600 beds and one of the best children's hospitals in the world. We have a level 1 trauma center, 11 floors of patient units, more than 20 operating rooms, first-of-its-kind delivery unit for babies with birth defects, a separate cardiac operative and catheterization suite, and places to learn, like our internationally recognized simulation center. We have trained generations of leaders in the field of pediatrics. We are world leaders in medicine, surgery, and science. One of the top recipients in NIH funding for pediatric research. In this building, pioneers in CAR T therapy, mitochondrial disease, brain tumors, hyperinsulinism, and other rare diseases. Here, groundbreaking work in fetal surgery, genetics and genomics, and neurology. In our newest building, leaders in social determinants of health, clinical informatics and epidemiology, autism, trauma and injury prevention. Our patients come from every state and 115 countries. Meeting these challenges requires the best and the brightest. We are passionate about pediatrics. We are motivated to make a difference in the world and in our community. We are a team. We are CHOP.
That's it, everyone, for another week of Women to Watch. Thanks so much for being with me. Next week, I'm going to be speaking with Madison Eggert. And Madison is the Vice President of Political Affairs for Comcast NBC Universal. Hope you all have a great week.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus, on edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.